Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it's a happy day because it's only half a week this week, right? Sad news is no labs this week. Sorry about that. But I can tell the angst, the sadness in the crowd. I'm amazed. Usually the Wednesday, like tomorrow, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, when everybody's out traveling, we've got nasty snowstorms blowing and all sorts of things. Like, East Coast gets it, we don't. So I hope all of you, if you're traveling somewhere, that you get there safely and get back. Of course, we got a few things that we got to get through before then, like the fourth quiz, which opens at 5 o'clock today. And we'll close at 5 o'clock tomorrow, so be sure to get on and take that quiz. It's just going to cover the glucose metabolism and the photosynthesis that we looked at, right? So you've got the lecture note pages there and the questions and so forth. And one more question and answer session today, right after lecture 12:15. So if you've got questions, I'll be glad to meet with you and give you some answers, and we'll talk about those things. If you can't make it then, I'll be in my office most of the afternoon. So you're welcome to come by and ask away and so forth. So let's get that fourth quiz over with, and then it will be all downhill to the final, or uphill as the case may be. So that is coming. The assignment that you turned in last Friday has been graded, is out in the boxes. Odd occurrence in the news about a cyanide poisoning. Every so often you hear about cyanide poisoning. One way or another, there have been some very, very famous instances of that, where whole masses of people have died from ingesting cyanide and so forth. It always intrigues me to read news accounts, as I mentioned before, and kind of pick out what's correct, what's incorrect in that. And of course, as the reporter was trying to explain to the general public how cyanide poisoning occurs, what happens, I think that reporter made a little bit of a mistake saying that it prevents oxygen from getting to the cells. It doesn't do that. I asked you to rewrite that sentence, right? More correctly, we talked about what cyanide does in class and the fact that it binds to that last cytochrome and prevents the transfer of low-energy electrons. So it's as if oxygen weren't in the cell. But it doesn't prevent oxygen from getting to the cell. What it does is prevent the cell from using that oxygen, right? So you can't transfer the electrons. And so everything backs up, and it's as if oxygen weren't there, but it is. It's just preventing that transfer. So hopefully you completed the sentence in just a few well-chosen words that would have reflected that idea. Of course, in the body, the potassium cyanide turns into hydrogen cyanide, which is a gas, and the fumes came rolling out. The poor student took so much cyanide that it poisoned or sickened 9 other people, right? The rescuers and others trying to help them and so forth. So a real sad situation that occurred there. And then I asked you to come up with some uses of cyanide today. Always think it's the bad guy and so forth. Of course, some of the uses you might have come up with might have kind of cemented that idea in your mind, like it's been used in gas chambers, and it's been used for fumigating things, and it's used in several industrial processes. I do have to tell you that a use implies you're using it for something. Just because it's found in something doesn't mean it's being used, right? So a few people in their searches discovered that cigarette smoke has cyanide gas in it. That is not a use of cyanide gas, okay? That's a byproduct of things that are burning in that cigarette. So if you put down a use as a component of cigarette smoke, that's not a use. That wouldn't have worked. And there were some other things. So we were looking for uses and references so that we could go directly to whatever that reference was that you used and verify whether that was correct or not. Yeah?
Would it be theoretically possible to distill cyanide gas from tobacco?
And why are you asking me? I don't know what it would take to actually separate the cyanide gas out from the tobacco smoke. And I
trace amount from a, obviously people aren't falling over dead from smoking cigarettes and there are people around them from that, so it's probably a very, very, very low amount. I'm sure that there probably are processes that you could use. Whether it would be economically feasible would be another question. So, I don't know. Probably the best way, if you're concerned about secondhand smoke and cyanide, would be to take smokers and put them in bubbles where the smoke can't get out. And that would take care of it for everybody else. Probably take care of it for them pretty quickly, too. So, anyway. Okay, so we had that. There's one more assignment that you're going to be doing, but it's not due until the last Friday of class. Unfortunately, I really don't like to have assignments due that day, but trying to keep them off of the quizzes and so forth, it forced me to that. It's one that I really want you to read about because it has to do with a gene called P53, which is turning out to be more and more and more critical when we look at cancer. And when that gene gets mutated, boy, it is creating problems. And the interesting thing about this particular article I'm going to have you read is that it makes a very firm linkage between cigarette smoke and mutation of the P53 gene. So I think you'll maybe find that an interesting article to look at. So that's going to be due a week from this Friday, and that will be that. Okay, so enough of those things. Oh, guess what I did all weekend? Yeah, about 115 creative projects came in. I do have to thank those of you that did it in doubles and triples, because that cut down. So, actually, I've got almost all of them graded. I'll make an announcement Tuesday, a week from today, about exactly what you can do to find out your score on the project, and if you would like to get your project back. There were some absolutely superb projects. I got to tell you, there's some that I'm hoping nobody will want back because I want to keep them and whatnot. So anyway, I will be turning back. My intention is to turn back that cover sheet that you turned in. And I've made comments on and so forth and the scores and whatnot. So minimally, that's going to get turned back to you in the boxes. Not until next week sometime, and then I'll talk with you more about how you might be able to get that project back if you'd like to get it back. It was a lot of fun. I've got to say I've never read so much about photosynthesis in my life. That seemed to be the favored project, and it's interesting, the different takes on photosynthesis. Anyway, so that'll all be coming back sometime soon. Okay, so I think that's it for the announcement. So we got a lot to do. Let's dive in and get going here. So we've been looking at the DNA, and last time we talked about, of course, DNA replication, and that hopefully is becoming very, very familiar to you now, how that process might work. At least on the surface, digging underneath and understanding really how that happens. How does that double helix really get unwound and so forth? It's still a lot, even though we know some proteins that do that, and we've assigned names to them, and we can say, okay, helicase unwinds it, and so, it's like, oh, come on, there's a lot more to it than that, that still has to be figured out. But, DNA replication, we talked last time about information in the molecule. You've been looking at that in lab for the last couple of weeks. So basically, we're taking this linear sequence of nucleotides that we find in the DNA molecule, and we're using that linear sequence to specify amino acids in a protein, right? So it's very much, as I said last time, very much like taking a language and translating it into another language if you're doing like a word-for-word translation that way. So we talked about what we would need in order to do. Well, let's go back. We talked about the genetic code, something you dealt with in lab this last week, and how we're really reading that in groups of three bases. And that's one of the things that really fooled the people. Remember, the debate is it nucleic acid, is it protein? Is it nucleic acid, is it protein? How could it be nucleic acid? It's so simple. It had never occurred to them at that point that maybe it was a code using multiple bases. So, you start looking at it that way, and sure enough, you can develop a genetic code, and it's all been worked out, and we talked about that table of the codes. Make sure you know how to use that table. Okay, so we talked about the table of the codes and how you could use that in order to figure out what amino acids are coded for by a region of DNA. So we talked about all those things. So we also talked about the components, right? So the fact that the DNA is the carrier of the hereditary material, that always is locked away in the nucleus except when the cell divides. And we'll talk more about that later. When the cell divides, that DNA gets out and gets split up. Other than that, it's locked away in the nucleus. And so how does that information get out? RNA molecules. So we talked about different kinds of RNA. So the messenger RNA, we saw was a complementary copy of one strand of the DNA, not both, but a single strand of the DNA that we call the antisense strand. Now you might wonder, how does the cell know which is the right strand? Because only one of those two strands is going to carry the information. And it turns out that what we would say upstream from the gene, okay, what does upstream mean? You think of a stream, and if you go upstream and you float down, you're going to go past all sorts of things. Well, the gene's down here that we want to make a copy of, upstream would be up above that gene, and then we would move down and make a copy of the gene. So upstream from the gene on the antisense strand are some series of nucleotides, very specific series, where proteins will bind. And they bind, when they bind there, then the process of opening up and stuff that we'll talk about in a minute, all that takes place. So the cells, the synthetic machinery in the cell identifies that strand by these certain sequences of bases. You're only going to find them on one of the two strands. Now, the odd thing about this whole thing, or the interesting thing, however you want to look at it, is that the antisense strand may be, let's say we got a strand here, an upper strand and a lower strand. The antisense strand for one gene may be the lower strand. The antisense strand for another gene may be the top strand. So we may be reading one gene going in this direction and another gene down here going in this direction. So you can't just say, this is the antisense strand for all the genes, this is, and so forth. It may flip-flop. And again, it kind of depends on, where are those sequences? And that determines how that all gets read off. Anyway, the messenger RNA is a complementary copy then of that gene that's made, and that carries the information out into the nucleus. And it's in the nucleus where the proteins are made. All right, we talked about another kind of RNA, the transfer RNA, is actually the translating device. Okay, it's through the transfer RNA that the cell is able to identify the codons for the amino acids that they specify. So we talked about how the transfer RNA has two key regions. One would be the anticodon, so the codon being the three nucleotides on the messenger RNA that specifies the amino acid. The anticodon being three bases that are complementary to the codon on the transfer RNA, so they're going to pair exactly, right, because one's complementary to the other. And that's on the transfer RNA, and then at the other end of the transfer RNA, we saw that there would be a specific amino acid attached. And that's where the specificity comes from. So in your lecture notes, let's go to page 50, top of page 58. Some ideas, things to think about. So 61 different codons for all the amino acids. We saw that when we looked at the table of codes. Remember, there were 64 possible codes. But three of those codes were stop codons, right? Three of those were like the periods at the end of the sentence. So take those away, there are 61 different codons that specify different amino acids. So doesn't it make sense that there must be 61 different transfer RNAs because each of those codons needs to be read by an anticodon? So simplest case, there would be 61 different transfer RNAs for the different amino acids. Only 20 amino acids, so the other thing that we looked at is, so getting back to the original thought, and I'll come back. So a particular amino acid is going to be attached to a particular transfer RNA that has the anticodon that will read the codon and insert that appropriate amino acid in the right place. So again, that's where we get our specificity from. Transfer RNA is almost like the dictionary you might use. Let's say you're going to translate something into Spanish, so you get on an English-Spanish-Spanish-English dictionary, you're going to read that. That's going to help you to figure out what the different words are. Transfer RNA is almost like that, because it's going to figure out what, it's going to put the appropriate amino acids in place in the, at the appropriate times. So 61 different codons, 61 different transfer RNAs, but the curious thing about that, that we talked about last time, was that having only 20 amino acids and needing to use up all of those codons, so there's nothing left hanging, any unused codon might also be interpreted as a stop. You certainly don't want 40 stop signals in your codon. So they all get used up, but three that are specifically the stop. And we saw that different amino acids might be attached to different numbers of transfer RNAs. It would be very specific. There are only two. We saw that there were only two amino acids that would be attached to just a single transfer RNA. So, like, thymine is always attached to the transfer RNA that has the anticodon AUG. Always going to put that's what's going to specify the thymine. And tryptophan always will. But then it goes up. So, like cysteine right here would be attached to two different transfer RNAs. One with the UGC and one with the UGU anticodon. So that there are two possible codons that might be read that would both insert cysteine at that particular place. And, you know, it goes up as high as six. This is arginine. Six different anticodons reading six different codons. So as you're going along and reading the code, there might be six different codons that would all be read as arginine. And arginine would always be put in that place based on the codon and the codon pairing.
So we've used up all the possible codes. We've got this so-called degenerate code that gives us all that uses up all these possibilities. And there are varying numbers of codes for different amino acids. So I hope that's not confusing. It's just, how do we use up all the code? That's how we do it. So some amino acids have more codons than others that are coding for them. But it's very specific. Every time we come to a particular codon, a particular transfer RNA is going to bind with that, and it's going to bring in its own particular amino acid. So again, that's where we get our specificity from the enzymes that attach the amino acids actually to the transfer RNAs. They're responsible for making sure that the correct amino acid is attached to the correct transfer RNA. So transfer RNAs are our decoding devices. That's how we're actually going to read the code and build the protein based on the code that we've gotten from the nucleus. So only one of the 20 amino acids may be attached to a particular tRNA, specificity. A particular amino acid may be attached to as many as six different tRNAs. Each one of those different codes then would read the same amino acid. And that's how we use up the code there. So what I really wanted to dive into today then is the making, and you've all been through it now in lab, making the protein. You've seen the process. I think there are a few perhaps misconceptions that I'll do away with today, hopefully, that you may have picked up because of the limitations of the model that we were using. So it was kind of limited in one way or another. But let's talk about this. We're going to be talking really about two processes. First process is called transcription. And in transcription, it's like you're transcribing a copy. Think about that. If you sat down with your lecture notes after class and you needed to make a copy and you didn't have access to a copy machine, but you needed a copy, you would transcribe a copy. You know, and hopefully you would be good enough, you would transcribe an exact copy of your notes. So that's the idea behind this word transcription. And when the copies of DNA that we're making are always going to be RNA copies. So when we talk about transcription, we're always talking about the making of an RNA molecule
based on the sequence of bases in a DNA molecule. And again, it's going to be in the antisense strand of that DNA molecule. That's what codes the information. So we talk about making messenger RNA. We say, oh, that's transcription. We're going to transcribe a copy of messenger RNA that we're going to use to carry that information out into the cytoplasm to use to make protein. Now listen carefully. When we talk about transfer RNA, okay, making transfer RNA, we're doing the same thing. So I think I mentioned this last time. Most often, the gene product that we're looking at is a protein, but remember, sometimes it's not. And there's a whole suite of genes that code for transfer RNA molecules. And so we would transcribe transfer RNA that would also go out into the cytoplasm, but it's not going to be used to make protein. It's going to be used to translate the code, right? So never are we going to try to take a transfer RNA molecule and read the code that's in it. That's not what we do with that. We're going to use it to actually translate the code based on the information, the message. So the messenger RNA always has the information to make the protein. The transfer RNA translates. So that's transcription. Transcription is the making of an RNA copy, a complementary copy of one strand of the DNA molecule, and it's always going to be the antisense strand that's being copied, right? Complementary copy. The other process that we're going to look at, and we'll go through these in more detail in a minute, the other process we call translation. That's where we're actually taking the code in the messenger RNA molecule, translating that into a protein. We're making the protein, using that code to make the protein. So that's the actual translation process, and for that, we're going to use the transfer RNA. Right? That's the translating device. That's our dictionary, as it were, however you want to look at it. We're going to use that to do it. Okay, so that's where we're headed today, to look at these processes. So let's look at transcription first. So we're there in the middle of page 58 still. Haven't gotten over. So, transcription is the making of a copy of RNA that's complementary to a sense strand. Gene in DNA. Okay, the making of a copy of RNA that's complementary to a sense strand. What are we doing here? Anti. That didn't make sense. No, that makes more sense. An antisense strand of a gene in DNA. Now, as I indicated there in the lecture notes, the mRNA is an exact complement to the sense strand, right? We want to carry that information out. If it's not an exact complement, then likely we're going to be making a protein that's not the protein we thought we were making. That we would wind up with an incorrect amino acid being added. The good news is, if the error occurs in the messenger RNA, you're only going to have as many bad proteins as long as that messenger RNA lasts in the cell. These things are constantly getting built and unbuilt, broken down, built up and broken down, built up and broken down. Whereas if that kind of an error occurs in the DNA, then you could carry that through from cell to cell to cell, generation to generation, and we'll talk about mutations later on, which would be what that would be. So it's an exact copy. So now let's flip back and forth between pages 58 and 59. So you've got a diagram there that I want to refer you to. So here's the nucleus here. It's got a membrane around it. The nucleus has very large holes in the membrane. We call pores. large enough that, that big molecules like RNA can move easily from the inside the nucleus on out. So, you know, the issues that we talked about before, how do you get through the membrane and so forth, don't count here because these are just big holes in the membrane to allow communication back and forth. So with transcription, we would have our double strand of DNA. The start of the gene would be identified, like I told you about earlier. There are going to be sequences that, that are being looked for that would indicate this is the start of a gene. And if this gene were what we call turned on, if it were going to be transcribed, then there are proteins that would separate the two strands. Now, a single DNA molecule could have 1,000 genes, 2,000 genes along its length, maybe more. So we're just talking about opening up a very small region of that molecule in order to copy this information. It's unlike replication, where we've got to really separate the whole thing eventually and copy the whole thing. It's not what's happening here. We're just opening up a very small region in order to make a messenger RNA copy so that we can take that information out into the cytoplasm. So this would open up. This indicate RNA polymerase, that's the name of that's the name of the protein that comes along and connects the RNA nucleotides together once they've lined up. So this would open up, and in this case, this top strand must be the antisense strand because I see we're making the RNA according to its sequence. So we would go along, and there are sequences at the end that would indicate this is the end of the gene. Now that's different from the end of the protein. So as we talked about the stop codes in the coding for the protein, but it's a different situation. How do we know where the end of the gene is? Which is probably going to be a ways beyond the end of the protein. So there are sequences that indicate that too. This is all figured out in the cell. So we're going to go ahead and make this RNA molecule here that is then going to be found in the nucleus. Now, what you've learned in lab, and probably what you've learned before when you have dealt with this kind of stuff, is that the next thing that will happen is that that messenger RNA is going to go from the nucleus out into the cytoplasm. It's not that simple. So, let me tell you about some things that go on. And you've learned about a little bit of this in lab when you're dealing with the introns and exons in that huge 4 pages worth of code and so forth. This messenger RNA molecule, we now know, by the time it gets out into the cytoplasm, is much shorter than what we started with. If we were to isolate that same messenger RNA in the nucleus, it would be much, much longer than what we find in the cytoplasm because it's been pruned. And those introns, intervening sections of RNA in the middle, have been cut out. And those exons that you learned about in lab have been spliced together. And so what you see in the message by the time it gets out here, it's much shorter because all the introns have been removed. There's a lot of research going into figuring out what in the world, how does that happen? How does how does the cell know how to precisely cut out those sections of that message that we don't want and retain those sections of that message that we do want? And it's a very, very interesting problem that people are working on. And it probably has to do with forming loops, and these loops get cut off and so forth. There's a lot of research going on for this. So we know that that message gets pruned back before it ever leaves the nucleus. So it's different. It looks very different by the time it gets in the cytoplasm than when it was in the nucleus. By the time it gets to cytoplasm, it's actually carrying the code for the protein that we want. So that's one thing kind of to file away about this process. Second thing is that it gets further modified. And we know that at the downstream end, okay, this is at the end, past the stop codes, okay, way down there, that there we tend to find a whole series of adenines that have been added. And this is oftentimes referred to as a poly-A tail. Poly-A tail. Poly, a bunch of adenines. Oops. bunch of adenines that get added. Now, why in the world do we do that? It's thought that that may have a function in protecting that messenger RNA so it doesn't get broken down as quickly. Because once it gets out into the cytoplasm, there are enzymes that are going to be breaking down the messenger RNA. The message, once it's made, has a lifetime, a defined lifetime. Some messages have very short lifetimes, some messages have much longer lifetimes. And as long as you have a message there, you're going to be making that protein. So some proteins you may only want to make for a short period of time. And there's no sense in continuing to make them, so those messages would have a very short lifetime. Whereas other proteins you may need to continue to make, so they would have, the message would have a longer lifetime to it. So we know that there's this poly-A tail that gets put on. And the other thing is there are some specialized nucleotides that we haven't talked about, and not going to really worry about their structure, but they're specialized. They're not the normal nucleotides. They're not the CAUG that we would expect in a RNA. And they've been given this name CAP. So on the start end, so upstream from where the message starts, we know now that these specialized nucleotides are placed there to help identify the start end. This will be the ending end and so forth. This all happens in the nucleus. So that by the time that message gets out into the cytoplasm, it's been highly modified from what you might have expected to find out in the cytoplasm. It's been capped, it's got the poly-A tail, it's been pruned. And yet, it contains the information, the specific information for the protein that we want to make. Okay, so transcription and modification going on in the nucleus, and then that will snake out through the pores, and we find it out in the cytoplasm. So that would be the kind of the first step of what's going on here. So now we've got our message out here in the cytoplasm. What do we do with it? The story moves now to the ribosomes. Ribosomes that are not making protein at the time actually are found in two pieces. And so I've drawn this ribosome to look kind of like a snowman. There's a larger piece and a smaller piece, but it really, you know, it helps us to understand what's going on, but they're obviously a lot more complicated than that. So what'll happen is the ribosome will identify the cap and this end, and it's going to attach to the start end, and it's going to move along until it finds the start codon, the first start codon. Now remember, that's methionine. So it's going to be zipping along here looking for that first AUG in the sequence. Now we may have other methionines in the protein, okay, but those wouldn't be appropriate start places. It's the first AUG that would be the start, that would indicate that's where to start building that protein from, the first AUG. So the ribosome is responsible for finding that, and then it will form, both pieces will come together, and they'll set up this platform on which we can make protein. So the ribosome is kind of like the machine, the platform on which the proteins are being made. The tRNA are the translating devices, right? They're going to bring the appropriate amino acids in at the right time. So the ribosome will assemble at the start end. It will identify the start message. It establishes, so by doing this, it establishes what we call the reading frame. The reading frame. How is that message going to be read? This sets that up. Look on the next couple pages, I think page 61. Let's look at that real quick. So I've given you on page 61 three identical pieces of messenger RNA. Okay, and we're kind of in the middle somewhere. We can't see the cap. The cap would be over here somewhere. The poly-A tail would be over here. We don't exactly know where we are in this, but I just wanted to demonstrate to you the reading frame. Let's suppose this is the start end. Let's suppose this is the first AUG. So the ribosome would come along, would identify that, would read that as the first. It would say, look, there's the first codon. That's going to be methionine. And then the next codon is simply going to be the next three nucleotides. Right? There's nothing that marks those off as codons. So the next three would be the next one, the next three would be the next one, and so forth. So we can mark that off into codons, and that's how that would be read. So this would be one amino acid, the next, the next, the next, the next. But there are two other reading frames that are possible, because we're using a code of three. So a second reading frame would be this. Let's suppose that that weren't the first AUG, or so. Suppose the ribosome makes a mistake. What if it thinks, that's the appropriate reading frame? Okay, so that UGC is a codon. Well, the next codon is simply going to be the next three and the next three and so on. I'm not going to take time right now to figure out what amino acids are we coding for here, but if you took the time, used the table, figured it out, you see you're getting totally different amino acids. That's in another reading frame, and the third reading frame would be over here. Let's suppose that that's a codon, and then this would be the next one, and the next one, and so on. And again, totally different amino acids from the other two. So establishing the proper reading frame is really critical to getting the proper protein out. And that's one of the things that the ribosome does, is to identify that first AUG that sets up the appropriate reading frame so that the amino acids can be read off properly. And that's because there's nothing that marks those off as codons. It's just the next three nucleotides are the next codon, or the next three are the next codon. Okay, so setting up that reading frame is critically important. That's a function
of the ribosome.
It gets a little help. We're not going to go into that, but it does that. So back to whatever page that was. Thank you. 59. This is where we're at now. We've got the ribosome that's assembled around the message. Let's put our cap out here. Our poly A tail is going to be out here somewhere. Who knows where that all that stuff is? But it's now identified the proper reading frame. So we have one codon here. We have a second codon here. Okay. These are identified as the P and A sites, but you really don't need to worry about that. Just it kind of helps sometimes to use the letters to keep straight where we're at on the ribosome. I mean, they have real names. We're not going to go into that, because if I told you what they were, you'd worry about them. So the P and the A sites. So now we're set up. Now we're ready to go. We're ready to begin translating. So transcription, let's make our RNA. It gets modified in the nucleus and so forth. It comes out. Ribosome assembles around, it sets up the reading frame, and now we're ready to translate. And if you look at page 60, we'll take a look at translation. So here we are with our ribosome around the start end. There's our AUG. We decide that's the reading frame, proper reading frame, and then here's a CCU. Those are our two codons that are able to be read. So the transfer RNA molecules now, thousands upon thousands, bazillions, you know, moles of transfer RNA maybe, out in the cytoplasm, each one having a particular anticodon and attached to it its particular amino acid, are going to start pairing up now. So here we have the AUG. Well, the anticodon is UAC. That transfer RNA with the UAC anticodon is always going to have methionine attached to it. Again, because the enzymes that are specifically recognizing these things and putting them together. So that's going to bring a methionine into position on the ribosome. The next codon is going to get read, CCU. Well, there's a GGA anticodon. That's always going to have the amino acid proline attached to it. So we've now brought two amino acids into position on the ribosome, sitting next to each other. The next thing that happens is that enzymatically, this methionine that's attached, and that's covalently bonded, by the way. There's a covalent bond holding it on. That bond gets transferred to the proline. Okay, so this bond gets broken, the bond that was holding the thiamine. At the same time, this is now going to get attached to the proline. So we wind up with a situation like this, where we've got the proline attached to its transfer RNA still, but now it's got the methionine attached to it. So we're starting to build an amino acid. Interestingly enough, you know, one thing I didn't tell you is that ribosomes, if we look at what they're composed of, they're about half RNA and about half protein. And I hate to throw another one at you, but the RNA in ribosomes we call ribosomal RNA. Right, so that's a third kind of RNA, rRNA, ribosomal RNA. And this is an example of one of those enzymes that's a non-protein enzyme. The enzyme that actually does this transfer is part of the RNA of the ribosome. So it's got enzymatic activity, and it's able to do this transfer. So that bond has, in essence, been shifted from the transfer RNA to the proline, to the amino acid that's at this A site on the ribosome. Now, this transfer RNA no longer has the methionine attached to it. It's released from the ribosome now. It's kicked off, as it were. And this is going to go back into the cytoplasm, and it'll get another methionine attached to it. So we're constantly going to be recycling these transfer RNA molecules. They're basically just transporting the appropriate amino acid to where it's going to get used in the protein, and then they're being released from that, go back and pick up another amino acid, and carry it in at the appropriate time. So this will get recharged, as it were. It'll get another methionine attached to it. So now, if we can ignore the fact that that's there, we've now got one transfer RNA with two amino acids, dipeptide here, sitting in this position. So the next thing that's going to happen is that the message is going to move down by three nucleotides, by a single codon. Okay, so that's what we see happening here. Now the AUG is out here. Here's our CCU, which is in this P site rather than the A site where it started off. And there's a new codon in the A site. Yeah. Like I said, if I tell you, then you're going to worry about it. So, it's just a way of kind of keeping track of where we're at here right now. Okay. So, and you can argue, you know, as from your point of view, is it the message that's moving through the ribosome, or is it the ribosome that's moving along the message? Kind of in your point of view, if we're looking at protein that's being formed on rough endoplasmic reticulum, clearly the ribosomes are held in position, so the message has to be moving through the ribosome. But if we're looking at protein that's being formed in the cytoplasm, it could be the other way, and that really doesn't matter. The point is, the message moves through the ribosome. So here we are now. We've moved down by three. Our dipeptide is here, and we're going to have another tRNA come in that would have the complementary, the anticodon for the codon. In this case, there's a UCU, so it's an AGA. That one always has the amino acid serine attached to it. So now we've brought a serine in. The same thing that happened up here is going to happen down here. So that RNA enzyme is going to break that bond. At the same time, it's going to transfer it over here so that we wind up now with a tripeptide. We've got the serine, the new serine that came in with a proline with the methionine attached to it. And this tRNA is now free to go off into the cytoplasm. It's going to get another proline attached to it, so it'll come back into play later on. So now we've got this codon open. This one has the transfer RNA, the tripeptide. We're going to shift another three nucleotides again. All right, so we just keep moving down that way. So here's our third codon now in this position. Here's a fourth codon that's come in, an AAA, which has an anticodon of UUU, and that's always going to bring lysine in. And again, we're going to cut this bond that's holding the serine. We'll transfer that over to the lysine. So we're going to wind up with four amino acids connected together. And that same process is going to repeat itself time and time and time again until we get to the stop codon, at which time the whole thing's going to terminate, and that protein that we've been making is going to be released from the ribosome, is going to be released from the transfer RNA that's holding it on there. Okay, so that's what's going on in the cell in terms of making the protein. Questions? No questions. Okay. So that's the process. Now, that's what goes on in the cell. If we're going to go ahead and translate that information, what are we going to use as a translating device? The table of the code, right? So if we had a messenger RNA molecule, we would have to know, we'd have to know, where do we start, right? Are we pretending like we're a cell and we've got a cap out here in the first AUG, that's where we start to read it, or are we pretending like we're somewhere in the middle of the gene and somebody would have to tell you what the proper reading frame was, because there are three different reading frames you could have. So we've got to know where to start, and then we can whip out our table and we can go ahead, and from that point on we can say, oh, it's this amino acid followed by this, and so forth, if we're trying to translate it. So the cell uses the tRNA, we'll use the table. Let me show you this in a kind of a different fashion now. Let me first of all make sure I haven't missed something I wanted to tell you. Okay. So let me show you this in a little bit different fashion. This is my moving picture version of all of this. So let's suppose here's our ribosome, our PNRA sites and so forth, and there's our message. So our ribosome has now formed around that. We've determined that AUG is the first codon, and in the cytoplasm we've got all of these different transfer RNA molecules kind of running around, bunches of them. Protein synthesis occurs really quickly. Okay, so hello, anybody else at home? Okay. So, what do we need? We need to start, get this going, and we're looking for a UAC. Wouldn't it be nice to have a UAC? Oh. Okay, so here we can have our first two transfer RNAs come in. This is going to read the AUG codon. This is going to read the UUU codon now, with complementary base pairs. Okay, so this would be a methionine and a phenylalanine that we would have lining up. The next thing that would happen, okay, my animation isn't as good as Disney's, so you have to kind of make believe here a little bit. So we've got them side by side, right? Remember, we're going to cleave this bond holding to the methionine. We're going to connect it now to the phenylalanine. All right, so we're going to shift that bond around. And then this transfer RNA is going to go off into the cytoplasm, where it's going to pick up another methionine. So that was our first step. Then we're going to move down by 3. And here we are now with our dipeptide here. And we now have a new codon that's showing up. So that's going to be read as an AAU, AAU, A, please be an AAU somewhere. AAU, AAU. This is not working out really well. Okay, so let's see. Oh, working out less well than I thought. Oh, no, okay. So the AAU is going to get red, and believe it or not, doesn't exactly work that way in the cell, but it does in my classroom. Okay, so now we've got, phenylalanine was connected to that one, right? And now we get the shifting of the bonds again. So we're going to take the phenylalanine methionine and shift that bond over to connect it to the leucine. So the AA, the tRNA with the AAU is always carrying leucine. So now this guy can go off into the cytoplasm somewhere and get a new phenylalanine attached. And now we've got our tripeptide held on by that transfer RNA. So we'll just do the same thing again. We'll shift down by 3. And that brings an AAG in position. And if you look at your table, the AAG should be a lysine. Okay, so look, the lysine comes into position right there. And interesting things. That bond will get shifted, okay, so that now we'll have the leucine phenylalanine methionine, that will be attached to the lysine. And for some reason, we do seem to be missing an intermediate here. Oop. Saved by the intermediate. Let's see, AAU, AAU, ooh, here we go. Okay, so that this is kind of clumsy, but I hope it makes the point. So now we're going to go ahead and do that bond shift again, right? So now we've got these four peptides connected together, and this now goes off in the cytoplasm to get a new leucine on it, and on it goes. Okay, we'll move down to the next one, and that's going to be a an AUG, 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 which is a tyrosine. Don't confuse the anticodon with the codon. You might think, wait a minute, I thought AUG was the start code. It is, but that's the codon over here. It's not the anticodon. We're reading, looking for the anticodon here. And so that's just going to keep going, right? So eventually we wind up with now this situation where we've got our five amino acids hooked together, and we'll just keep going, right? And at some point I'm going to have to give this up because I'm running out of pieces. But we just keep going and keep reading that down the line until we come to the stop code, which would signify that we're at the end. Okay, questions about how we make proteins? You need to know how to do this. Yeah?
So the ribosome is just pulling those out of the cytoplasm?
Now, actually, the ribosome isn't pulling them out. They're just randomly striking and hitting. And that's what makes this all the more amazing. I mean, these things are just kind of moving around on their own and stuff. And they really have to randomly move into position. And there will be a little bit of an attractive force once they get close, but not fully close. They're going to kind of randomly, other tRNAs are going to be trying to fit, but they won't fit because they don't have the right chromosome set. But eventually the correct one will fit. And this happens really well.
So, in the event, say there was like a UUU bulk, and the AA was spit out, and it didn't have anything attached to it, is there any chance that
it's not going to go back again? Okay. It needs to have that amino acid attached to it.
I suppose we wouldn't really know. I mean, there's so many millions of ribosomes, and when we're producing a particular protein, we don't just make a single RNA copy. We make probably thousands of copies of that RNA to go out into the cytoplasm to make the protein. And so I suppose if an error like that did happen, it would kind of foul things up at that point, but you have all the rest of them that would be working okay, so I doubt we even know it. Okay, other questions about making proteins? So over at the top of page 62 then, the result of all this is that we've made a protein that's a linear sequence of amino acids that directly reflects the linear sequence of nucleotides in the mRNA. So we've taken that one sequence, we've converted it into another sequence that's needed by the cell in order to function. Okay, let's take a break here and let your minds rest a little bit, and then we'll get on to some more things in a minute. Okay, I want to call your attention. Announcement. One of the announcements I forgot to make. I have now posted out in the display case next to where you find the grading keys for the homework assignments. In the next display case, I posted a list of all of your in and out of class scores for the first five assignments and so forth. So they're posted by the last four digits of your student ID number. I'd appreciate it if you would take a minute soon and look at those and make sure that I'm not missing anything or that I haven't misrecorded something or whatever. I depend upon you to kind of check me on that. So that's all out there in that display case. You can take a look at it. Okay, I thought I would show you. Some things that you have available to you, and I thought maybe we would look at one of these. So what I'm looking at here is the review page that you can access from Moodle. And you'll notice review, blah, 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 and so forth. And a lot of links that I've provided on that page that have been there and will continue to be there for different topics. I know some of you took advantage of some of the earlier ones having to do with chemistry and so forth, or photosynthesis or respiration, to review those kinds of things. But I want to point out that there are a number of links that are there dealing with these processes that we've been looking at, dealing with the DNA, transcription, translation, and so forth. And I thought maybe we would look at one of these. With fear and trembling, I show you this because I was watching it this morning, and unfortunately, they put a lot of money into the program, and it's got some errors in it, but let's take a look at it. These are basically
proteins of how a simple code has turned into flesh and blood. This is what Francis Crick called the central dogma of modern biology. How DNA makes protein. It starts with a bundle of factors assembling at the start of a gene. It's these that trigger the first phase of the process, reading off the information that will be needed to make the protein. The gene is the length of DNA stretching way to the left. Everything's ready to roll. 3, 2, 1. The blue molecule racing along the DNA is reading the gene. It's unzipping the double helix and copying one of the two strands. The yellow chain snaking out of the top is a copy of the genetic message, and it's made of a close chemical cousin of DNA called RNA. The building blocks to make the RNA enter through an intake hole. They are matched to the DNA, letter by letter, to make an exact copy of the A's, C's, G's, and T's of the gene. The only difference is that in the RNA copy, the letter T is replaced with a closely related nucleic acid known as U. You are watching this process called transcription in real time. It's happening right now in almost every cell in your body. When the RNA copy is complete, it snakes away from the nucleus and into the outer part of the cell. Then, in a dazzling display of choreography, all the components of another molecular machine lock together around the RNA to form a miniature factory called a ribosome. It translates the genetic information in the RNA into a string of amino acids that will become a protein. Special transfer molecules, the green triangles, bring each amino acid to the ribosome. The amino acids are the small red tips attached to the transfer molecules. There are different transfer molecules for each of the 20 amino acids. They all carry a specific three-letter code that will be read by the machine. Now we come to the heart of the process. Inside the ribosome, the RNA is pulled through like a tape. The code for each amino acid is read off, three letters at a time, and matched to three corresponding letters on the transfer molecule. When the right transfer molecule plugs in, the amino acid it carries is added to the growing protein chain. Again, you are watching this in real time. And after a few seconds, the assembled protein starts to emerge from the ribosome. Ribosomes can make any kind of protein. It just depends what genetic message you feed in on the RNA. In this case, the end product is hemoglobin. The cells in our bone marrow churn out 100 trillion molecules of it per second.
So you've got several of these that you can go and access and look. I think it kind of helps to see that. Some of the errors, I don't quite know why they make it sound like you can use either strand of the DNA. Obviously, you can only use a single strand. They talk about the only difference between the RNA and the DNA being the U replacing the T. Well, of course, we know that there's complementarity that goes on. Kind of makes it sound like you're just reading a strand, and when you come to a T, you just put in a U. No, it's complementarity. The ribosome itself, they call the translating device. Well, no, the ribosome is the platform on which it happens, right? And the tRNA molecules are actually translating. They're the ones that make it all happen. So a few little rough spots in it, but at least it does help you maybe to visualize better what's going on in that process. And there's some good ones have to do with replication and so forth. So I'd encourage you, if you've got some spare time, you might want to go and look at those. Okay, he mentioned the central dogma of biology, and I want to talk with you a little bit about that, which has to do with the direction of information flow in the cell. How's information flowing in the cell? And you have it there sort of in the top part of page 62. And this central dogma of biology really reflects a major change in thought when you think back to where people were arguing over protein or nucleic acid or whatever. It reflects our understanding now. Now, I'm going to be using arrows, but it's not that these things that the arrows are pointing from and to are changing into these things. Again, the arrows represent the flow of information. So where's information going in the cell? So here's what the central dogma looks like. DNA carries the information to form RNA. The RNA, this would be the messenger RNA specifically now, carries the information to form proteins. You notice those arrows, the arrows do not go back on each other. We're seeing information flow that way. Now, DNA also carries the information to form more DNA, right? So we would put an arrow like that. Now, what would we call this arrow? What's this process?
Transcription.
What's this process? Making protein? Translation. what's this process making more DNA? Replication, right. So that's what's represented there. Central dogma biology, that's the direction information is flowing. Now, interesting enough, there's a group of viruses called the retroviruses that violate this. And so we've had to modify this a little bit because of those. Now, keep in mind, again, viruses are non-living infectious particles, right? So for all living organisms, this is how information would flow. But for retroviruses, they actually carry as their hereditary material RNA. So how in the world does that work? When it's a DNA world that's carrying the information and they carry RNA, what they do when they infect, their RNA gets into the cell and they carry a couple of molecules along with them called reverse transcriptase. This is transcription, right? So you think, okay, reverse transcriptase will take an RNA copy and convert it into a double-stranded DNA. And then that double-stranded DNA will incorporate itself into the host DNA, and from that position, direct the formation of viral particles, just like we understand this whole process to work. Okay, so these are the retroviruses. That carry the RNA. This is only going to happen in the presence of reverse transcriptase. Retroviruses, until about 1985, were thought to be really interesting little anomalies and so forth. People were studying. There were a few very well-known retroviruses that they were studying, but they were kind of off, way off on the sidetrack. 1985, I believe it was 1985 when HIV was identified as the virus that causes AIDS. HIV is a retrovirus. And so all of a sudden, the retroviruses got a ton of attention. And we've learned a lot more about how retroviruses work. And some of this with the idea of how do we prevent HIV from infecting? How do we prevent it from going through this process? Can we somehow make it so that its reverse transcriptase doesn't work? There are all sorts of different approaches that have been tried in order to quell HIV problems and so forth. But that's now what we would call the central dogma of biology. Now, going along with that was another idea that came up fairly early on as people were working with this, trying to figure it out. It was called one gene, one polypeptide. One gene, one polypeptide. Now, that originally started off as one gene, one protein. But as people did more and more work with proteins, and they realized that there are proteins that have quaternary structure, that where two or more polypeptide chains come together to form the active protein, this got modified now to one gene, one polypeptide, the idea that everything that we identify as a gene is going to code for a particular polypeptide. And that's probably what you've heard in the past, too. In the last few years, that's been challenged. One of the main reasons for challenging that was the Human Genome Project, which you probably heard about. Project to sequence the entire human genome, all 3.2 billion bases. And I'll talk more about it later, probably Tuesday. But when the Human Genome Project was completed to the point where people could begin to ask, how many genes are there in the human genome? The estimate originally had been that there would be about 100,000 genes in the human genome based on the different proteins and so forth. And when they went looking for genes, and they simply looked for genes by looking for those little sequences that I told you about that are upstream from the beginning of a gene. So every time you find one of those, you figure, okay, there's a gene downstream from that. What they found, surprisingly, was only about 20,000 genes. And they started scratching their heads thinking, what in the world, how can there be only 20,000 genes, and yet we estimate 100,000 different proteins? And that comes back to this idea, one gene, one polypeptide. Remember when I was talking with you about RNA and the RNA getting pruned in the nucleus? So you form this really long RNA molecule, and it gets pruned, and what you find outside the nucleus is a lot shorter than what you find inside. The thinking now is that there are different ways to prune that RNA, so that one gene may actually code for 5 or 6 different polypeptides, depending on how that RNA molecule has been pruned, which regions have been identified as introns that have been cut out and then reassembled as all the exons. So that's an area of a lot of research right now, trying to figure out exactly what's going on and how can it be. How can one gene code for more than one polypeptide, even with that pruning mechanism and so forth? So it's kind of a classic example of we get to where we think we know exactly how it's all working, and then all of a sudden we find out we don't know near as much as we thought we knew. A whole new vistas open up. This happens to physicists all the time. We're always looking for one equation that will describe the whole universe, right? And every time they think they've got it, they discover that they don't. And biologists have the same kinds of problems. So a lot of interesting research going on in this field of DNA and how do we, what happens to that RNA and what turns genes on and off, all sorts of different things going on there. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about mutations before I finish up with the DNA here. And so, yeah, let's turn the page. Mutations. A mutation. Mutation might be defined as any change in the DNA sequence of a gene. Okay, any change in the DNA sequence of a gene. Now, one of the problems that people are dealing with now, and as more and more data comes in, we might be able to pin this down, but that is, what's the so-called normal sequence? What does it look like? And as you're looking at the genome of various organisms, you have to collect a lot of data from different examples of a species before you can begin to say, okay, this is what the normal gene looks like, this is the sequence, and so genes that don't look like this, those are mutated genes. So that's a problem in the background. But let's just kind of leave it, any change in the DNA sequence. Now, in lab, you dealt with mutations looking at the hemoglobin molecule. Now, remember, the types of the amino acids and their sequences are very important because they determine the shape of the protein, they determine the function of the protein, they determine where that protein is going to be located in the cell. So if there are mutational changes where the DNA is changing and that's changing the code, the messenger RNA, and we're getting different proteins inserted in, or I'm sorry, different amino acids inserted in, that means we're going to start to change our proteins, right? And the nature, the magnitude of that change depends upon where that change is occurring and what the nature of that change is and so forth, to the point where even the tiniest change could cause you to have a non-functional protein. Or it could not matter at all. I mean, it just kind of depends on these things. Now, you looked at sickle cell anemia in lab,
and I've got a couple of pictures I want to show you. This is a picture of normal red blood cells. That's what they would look like if you were looking at them in the microscope. Those of you that are in biology 102 next term, one of the first things you're going to do in lab is look at normal red blood cells. They're tiny, tiny cells. They're a bit of a challenge to even find under the microscope until you know what you're looking for, but that's what they look like. They're round. They look like they have a white spot in the center. You say, well, is that the nucleus? No. It's because they're what we call biconcave, which means that if you were to look at the cell kind of on the side, you'd see that there's a thicker ridge around the outside, and then they kind of go in the middle, and then they come back out again. Red blood cells are filled with hemoglobin, just absolutely filled with hemoglobin. Their one function is to carry oxygen around the cell, or around the body. They don't even have a nucleus. Human red blood cells don't have a nucleus, so that means that they have a real limited lifetime, probably about 80, 85 days, something like that.
So that's what normal red blood cells look like. Now, in sickle cell anemia, if you look amongst those normal red blood cells, you'll see cells that are misshapen. Okay, those are sickle cells. Those are cells of sickle cell anemia. And what happens is, in sickle cell anemia, the hemoglobin molecule, which is a complex molecule, is four polypeptide chains. There are two what we call alpha chains and two what we call beta chains that come together to form the functional hemoglobin molecule. In sickle cell anemia, the beta chain has a mutation in it. And that mutation causes, under low oxygen conditions, causes the hemoglobin to actually fall out of solution. And it forms long needle-like structures, long needle-like crystals in the cell. And that's what causes those cells to become misshapen. Those misshapen cells will break easily. Therefore, people have anemia. They've got low hemoglobin levels. They cause problems in organs. They can damage organs. They can block capillary beds in organs. They can do all sorts of mischief. Sickle cell anemia is not a real fun thing to have. And here's kind of a close-up comparing normal hemoglobin cells with sickle cells. Once they sickle, it's really difficult to get them back into the normal shape. So once they've sickled, once they've gone through an area of low oxygen, like maybe somebody's running, right, and they're going into oxygen debt, perhaps, or maybe not even oxygen debt, their legs, but low oxygen, the cells start to sickle. Very, very difficult to get them back to the normal shape. So it creates untold misery for people as short as lifespans. Now, in lab, you saw that sickle cell anemia is caused by a very, very small mutation. So at the number six position, diagram somewhere stuck away a few pages earlier, but this is the beta chain of hemoglobin. It's this number six amino acid right here. It's normally a glutamic acid. That's the one that's affected by this mutation. 56. Page 56, thank you. So, I mean, it's not like you have, I don't even know if you can read the lettering there, but that's the one that's affected. Now, glutamic acid, if we were to look at the protein, okay, so there's the backbone of the protein. And I'm just going to look at the side group of the glutamic acid. The R group, remember what's different on the amino acids is their R group. What does that look like? So glutamic acid looks like this. Okay, that's glutamic acid. That's what's normally at that number six position. In the beta chain of the hemoglobin. In sickle cell, we find that another amino acid has been substituted for that. So instead of glutamic acid, we have one called valine, and valine looks like this. Okay, so you'd say, well, okay, they're both three carbon, but you notice this one's branching. This one is a polar amino acid. There's a carboxylic acid group. It's polar. This is a nonpolar. Very different characteristics of those two amino acids, and it happens to be in this critical location where it causes the hemoglobin to fall out of solution under low oxygen. Very, very critical position. So a single substitution, that's all it is. A single substitution of a valine for a glutamic acid. Now, say, okay, what might have caused that? You can kind of work backwards. So one codon for glutamic acid is GAA. Now, you can go to the table and you can look up and see what the different codons are, but that's one particular codon. And one codon for valine is GUA. Okay, so those are the codons in the messenger RNA. So if we track that back to the DNA, so this would be the synth strand of the DNA. Remember, they're complementary. So this would be CTT, and this would be CAT. So it looks like what's happened is that we've had a simple substitution at this location right here where there should be a thymine. For some reason, an adenine was substituted. That's a mutation. And now we now know we've analyzed the protein. We know that. We've analyzed the DNA. We know that that's what it is, a simple substitution of one amino acid for another, one base for another, which gives us one amino acid being substituted for another, which happens to be in a critical location. So that's what we call a point mutation. A point mutation, where we're looking at one single place. Now, that's an example, one example of types of mutations. What I would like for you to do, because we're not going to really have time to go through this, is to look at pages 63, 64, and 65, to the middle of page 65, where it talks about different kinds of mutations. Read through that and become familiar with different kinds of mutations that we might see. And I've given you examples of what that effect that it might have on a simple sentence there, so you can look at that. And see, so not only mutations, but what causes mutations, mutagens. So you're responsible for looking at that for the final, okay? And that be it. Have a great Thanksgiving. See you all next week.